Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sixth BRICS summit underway in Brazil following the World Cup, where the leaders of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are meeting to forge an economic development alternative to the US and European-led World Bank and IMF. Peter Hakim, the President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue, joins us to discuss whether a proposed new BRICS development bank with starting capital of $50 billion is the beginning of a new economic bloc emerging on the world financial stage that was shaken by the Wall Street crash of 2008, leading vulnerable nations to challenge the post-World War II Bretton Woods global financial regime long dominated by the United States. Then we'll examine the apparently calibrated military responses to Ukrainian offensives against pro-Russian rebels in the East that suggest Russia's President Putin is using a combination of military force, covert operations, and disinformation to continue his destabilization of the new government in Kiev, short of provoking a Western response that would increase sanctions. Alexander Motyl, a professor of political science at Rutgers University, who is a specialist on Russia and Ukraine, joins us to discuss how, while Putin's strategy is still popular in Russia, his use of Russian and Ukrainian thugs and criminals as proxies has turned the Ukrainian people against him. Then finally, as a sign that decency might be prevailing over criminality, we will discuss the collapse of a leading for-profit college, Corinthian, and the just-announced investigation of the University of Phoenix with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report and the founding director of Campus Progress. We will assess the fate of President Obama's latest effort to rein in the abuses of a $32 billion a year predatory industry that is subsidized almost entirely by taxpayer money, used to bilk young Americans and veterans into taking on crippling student debt while providing worthless diplomas and scant prospects of employment. And joining us now is Peter Hakim, who is the President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue. Previously, he was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation and worked for the Ford Foundation in both New York and Latin America. He's held teaching positions at MIT and Columbia and has served on the boards and advisory committees of the World Bank Council on Competitiveness, Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs en Español, and Partner for Democracy Change and Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Hakim.
Thank you.
And the BRICS summit, the sixth BRICS summit, is underway in Brazil. And, of course, it followed the World Cup. And the BRICS, of course, are Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. So what's your sense then? I guess they're still meeting and probably, tomorrow they'll come out with a communique. But there seems to be some indication that they may come up with some kind of alternative to the World Bank and the other Bretton Woods creations that have dominated international finance. Is that what's going on here?
Well, this is their first effort to really create an institutional structure beyond the annual meetings they now held. And clearly they're aiming for showing their influence on issues of global economic management, and the way they've chose to do so is to create institutions that in one way mimic the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, but will also have the stamp of these five countries on them and serve these five countries in ways that they feel the bank and the fund is not.
Well, already these countries, their economies comprise 21% of global GDP. Is there anything in the BRICS arrangements or the ones that may come out of this sixth summit in Brazil that would indicate a kind of common market within the BRICS?
I think that's a long way off. The BRICS don't have much of a trading relationship with each other, except all of them have pretty ample trade with China. But the outside of that relationship, the BRICS are not a group of countries that has very large trade flows between them. My guess is that their main interest is increasing their influence, their standing in the international community, in international institutions. Two events really, I think, influence the way the BRICS see themselves. One was the global economic crisis that began with the failure of the Lehman Brothers and really extended throughout the world, which they in part blame on the developed countries, the United States and Europe, and the institutions they created. And secondly was the fact that in the last round, these countries wanted to have candidates to be president of the World Bank and managing director of the International Monetary Fund. And the United States and Europe just stuck with their old formula of having an American head the World Bank and a European head the IMF. And I think that's what really propelled them. The global economic crisis, plus their inability to gain real influence within the traditional financial institutions. And that's what they're going after now, is to create these alternatives to show they can do it and gain access back to the traditional ones, probably. It's hard to measure whether they really want their own institutions or they want to move up the rung in the traditional institutions.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Hakim, who is the President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue and previously was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation and worked for the Ford Foundation in both New York and Latin America. He's held teaching positions at MIT and Columbia and has served on the boards and advisory committees of the World Bank, Council on Competitiveness, Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs en Español, and Partners for Democratic Change and Human Rights Watch. So, but you can't blame these countries. I mean, it wasn't the 2008 crisis entirely the fault of Wall Street and speculation? And isn't it true that there is a bias or at least a tradition here of having an American in charge of the World Bank and a European in charge of the IMF?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, it's also true that two of the BRICS, Russia and China, occupy permanent seats at the United Nations Security Council, that it looks now like the IMF and the World Bank will probably select their leadership from beyond Europe and the United States. The World Trade Organization now has a Brazilian director. So, in other words, things are evolving not quite as fast probably as the BRICS would like them. And not necessarily fully in the direction they would like.
But is this happening because of BRICS, the creation of BRICS?
I don't think so. I think that when one looks at the BRICS, yeah, five of these major countries, these emerging economic challengers, probably better than any one of them, but you know, it's really China that's the main player here. You know, you mentioned that they have 21-22% of the world's economic output. Well, half of that is China. They have large reserves. 90% of the reserves are with China. The trading patterns, these countries are not major world traders except for China. So it's really, you know, China and the others. And China, you know, sooner or later is going to really have much more influence and power than it even has now.
So in terms of the trading partners, there really isn't a lot of trade going on because Brazil is one of the most closed economies around, isn't it? It's highly protected.
That's precisely right. Yeah. The others are fairly open economies. But, you know, while China is the first or second trading partner of every other BRIC, the four remaining BRICs have very little commerce among them.
So is there any chance then of others joining? I mean, I'm not sure what they're joining here because I'm not getting a clear picture here, Peter.
Well, it's sort of a loose alliance. They meet every year. They discuss international affairs, discuss how the context is evolving and how they can occupy a more central role. But they don't share a lot of interest. They don't share a lot of commonalities generally. They're Some of them are democracies, some are autocratic governments, some, like you said, are very open economies, some are closed economies, some are really still growing rapidly like China, others are stumbling along at this point. They, of course, two or three of them are very major military powers, China and Russia particularly. The other three have very limited military capacity. So they're not a group of countries that would have come together on their own. They're countries that came together because this idea of the BRICS, the emerging markets, was invented by an official at Goldman Sachs, and they thought they would take advantage of this, gave them a certain platform, and sure, they probably do have a little more panache, a little more influence, because they're working together. But it's not a natural alliance the way NATO is, or that the European Union is, or even NAFTA.
So would you describe it as a reaction to Anglo-Saxon domination of the global economy?
Well, in part, there is that. There's a few ideas that they particularly don't like. The heavy U.S. influence in most of these institutions, coupled with the European, it's hard to sort of get a word in edgewise for the other countries. They see themselves as trying to shape something of a new world order, while at the same time, in many ways, imitating the institutions of the old world order, occupying important places in the old world order, and trying to increase their own influence in it. So it's a combination. You asked before whether they're interested in bringing other countries into their alliance, let's say. Well, that's a good question. It's unclear right now whether they really want to be an exclusive club that gives them a certain standing, or whether they want really the influence that might come if they were to incorporate a dozen more countries, countries like a Mexico, a Turkey, an Indonesia, an Egypt, other large developing countries that also have important economic and political potential. They haven't really made up their mind on that.
Well, if that were to happen, the countries that you mentioned, and I guess you could include Venezuela as well, that would be a substantial block, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would certainly be a substantial bloc, but it would no longer be an exclusive club.
I see. And there's no indications that they would ever loosen trade restrictions within form some kind of common market like the European Union and other organizations.
It's very, very unlikely at this point. I mean, that would take a long stretch to imagine these five countries. Very hard. These are countries that don't have economic alliances with many other countries. They are big countries. They look internally as well as externally. Brazil has, you know, four or five neighbors it has free trade agreements with. Most of the other countries have only a smattering of free trade agreements. They haven't been involved really intensively in building the kinds of trade arrangements that the Europeans and the United States and some of the other Asian countries have done.
So, Peter Hakim, assuming that the final communique coming out either tomorrow or the next day from the BRICS 6th summit in Brazil that followed the World Cup, assuming that reports are accurate, that they're going to announce, the BRICS are going to announce a BRICS development bank with a starting capital of at least $50 billion, who would they be lending that kind of money to?
Well, that's one of the questions right now. It's going to take everybody that I've talked to tells me it takes at least 4 or 5, maybe more years to get a real serious development bank up and running. Countries, many of them have experiences with their domestic development banks, the national development banks, but it's very different when you have to construct the governing structure. They're still debating where the bank will be located, who will be its first president, etc. So getting the rules right, staffing the bank, setting out the rules for making the loans, it's quite a ways off. But the initial indication seemed to me the bank is going to lend to the five members of the BRICS group, and maybe at a future time they'll be open up their lending window to other developing nations. But right now it's very hard to tell from the announcements they've made.
Well, just a final question, Peter Hakim. There's been talk for the longest time about the idea that a lot of countries chafe at the idea that the U.S. is the global trading, the dollar is the global trading currency, and that this gives the U.S. enormous economic advantage. And there were talk of you know, not paying for oil in dollars anymore. You keep hearing these talks, but nothing seems to develop along those lines. Is there any possibility that the BRICS could challenge the dollar?
Well, you know, the Chinese have been eager more and more to use their own currency. If the five BRIC nations were willing to really sort of create a bank that would use the renminbi, the Chinese currency, yeah, there might be a challenge at some level. But remember that you mentioned they have these five countries at 21% of the world's economy. The U.S. alone has about 25%. The European Union has slightly more. So there are other competitors here to the BRICS, and they are certainly more unified. In other words, I hope the United States, even with its current political divisions, has more unity than the five BRIC countries, and it's a lot easier for a single country to make decisions, whether it's about quantitative easing, the way the central bank is going to be working, interest rates, than it is for five countries to jointly do so.
Well, Pete Hakim, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Hakim, who is the President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue. Previously, he was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation and worked for the Ford Foundation in both New York and Latin America, and has held teaching positions at MIT and Columbia, and served on the boards and advisory committees for the World Bank, Council on Competitiveness, Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs en Español, and Partners for Democratic Change and Human Rights Watch. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the apparently calibrated military tit-for-tat responses between pro-Russian rebels and Ukrainian forces in eastern Ukraine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Mertl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. He's a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. He's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Mertl.
Thank you for having me again.
And it does seem that every time the Ukrainian military make advances against the rebels in the east, that something happens largely from the Russian side that seems to be very carefully calibrated to match whatever military advances that the Ukrainian government are making. It feels to me as if the hand of Putin is active there in this game of continual destabilization.
Well, there's no question about it. Within the last week and a half, the Ukrainian army has made significant advances. It's recaptured about one-third to one-half of the territory that used to be controlled by the commandos, including a fairly large number of cities, medium-sized cities, towns, and villages. And it was in the process of cutting the militant-held territory in two, and it may still be in the process of doing that. And just as soon as this is going, as this is happening, and it seems like the terrorists, the commandos, the militants are on the run, they're increasingly having defections within their own ranks, Russia ups the ante. And it was last week, but especially over the weekend, that Russian vehicles, armored personnel carriers, jeeps, tanks, started crossing the border from Russia into Ukraine. Much more so than in the past. And this time they were doing it brazenly. In the past, when they crossed, they didn't have Russian insignia or flags. This time they went with the insignia and flags. And as you know, it was yesterday, I believe, that a Ukrainian plane was shot down. It looks like it was shot down from the Russian side by the Russians. And the reason for that is that it was several thousand feet into the air, and the commandos don't seem to have the kind of surface-to-air missiles that would be able to do the trick. That would make sense in as much as one of the advantages that the Ukrainian military has had over the militants is air power, and it's been able to use it quite effectively in destroying equipment as well as destroying terrorist concentrations. So this is clearly a way, I think, this seems to be clearly a way of Russia's trying to put a halt, or at least trying to slow down the Ukrainian military's advance.
So what do you think is happening with these rockets that struck the town of Syzny in the Donetsk region? The Ukrainian authorities are now claiming that that attack actually came from Russia. It was an attack that was supposed to make the Ukrainians look as if they were murdering civilians. What's the latest on that?
That's essentially the latest. I mean, what you have is exactly what they've been saying. I mean, the attack took place, you know, just yesterday. And, you know, this town, you know, small town happens to be located very close to the border. And it's been contested by both sides. And, you know, if you think about it from any kind of strategic point of view, it just doesn't make any sense for the Ukrainian forces to be shooting at a town that they're trying to occupy and thereby alienating the local population. So their suggestion is, I think, quite accurate. There have been other instances like this in the past. And there have been many instances of the local militants firing pretty much randomly at civilian populated areas, partly, I think, to cause a sense of terror and partly to suggest, you know, to point fingers at the Ukrainian military and say, look, these are the guys who are actually engaging in this. Ultimately, what this means, however, I think, and again, this is a hunch because I don't know what's going on in Putin's head, I think all these measures are ultimately signs of desperation on the part of the Russian regime. They were hoping for an uprising in eastern Ukraine, for a pro-Russian uprising in eastern Ukraine that would encompass seven or eight provinces. Instead, what they found was that the level of support for Russia and the level of support for the insurgents was confined to a relatively small area, and that in the recent weeks and recent months, that level of support has dwindled. It's coming, you know, it's approximating zero. And in the towns that the Ukrainian military liberated in the last week and a half or so, The response on the part of the local population was, thank God you're here, what took you so long? And it's not surprising because the militants, the insurgents, really have nothing to offer. They have no game plan. So what they generally do is they rob banks in order to get the money to sustain themselves. They've been destroying infrastructure, buildings, bridges, roads, fairly randomly. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason to it. And the number of civilian casualties as a result of their predations have been rising. So Putin is in a bit of a pickle because the region, the population of the region doesn't want him, certainly doesn't want the militants. They've lost the battle for the hearts and minds of these people. And what now is he to do? Well, he can continue sowing chaos and destruction, but ultimately the question is, to what end? Because at some point, the Donbass, this particular region, will be devastated, the population will leave, and then regardless of who wins, there'll be winners on a bunch of ruins.
Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Motyl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter, and he previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. And his latest book is The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. So what then do we make of the increase in Russian troops on the Ukrainian border? The numbers apparently are up to 12,000 now. There obviously were more, 40,000 in the area a couple of months ago, but then they pulled back. But now they seem to be returning. Is this, again, just a psychological operation in context of what you were just saying, which is that Putin doesn't really have much of a plan except to continually destabilize Ukraine?
Well, it's certainly that. I mean, there's no question that this is a question of intimidation. These troops are intended to engage in this kind of saber-rattling. This is what Russia's been doing for the last 3-4 months. It's not inconceivable that at some point Putin may decide they have to go in. Imagine the following scenario, that the Ukrainian military continues squeezing the militants. The militants withdraw, perhaps at some point even chaotically. I mean, that's what they did last week, by the way. And then Putin faces the possibility of a complete humiliation within eastern Ukraine, where his entire political project, this attempt to destabilize the country, this attempt to annex parts of eastern Ukraine, may be facing complete defeat. It's not inconceivable that he could, in an attempt to forestall that very embarrassing scenario, send in, say, 5,000 or 10,000 troops in order to create safe zones, possibly hit the Ukrainian military from the back. The question is, what then, you see? I mean, this is still the problem that he faces. Even if he were to do that, I mean, the result might be a significant deterioration of the Ukrainian army, although I'm not so sure, because they've been fighting very well. 3 months ago, if you had asked me, would the Russians defeat the Ukrainians, I would have said easily. It would have been a cakewalk. Now it's no longer a cakewalk. So in any case, what then would Putin achieve? Well, he might be able to prevent the terrorists from being completely annihilated. He might be able to sustain small enclaves within eastern Ukraine. And then what? There really is no particular game plan. I mean, he was hoping, as I said, for some kind of all-national popular uprising on the part of the eastern Ukrainians, and that never took place.
Well, the head of NATO recently pointed out that Putin has mastered this new form of hybrid warfare where he uses military force, covert operations, and disinformation in tandem, and that seems to be the case. But I guess what's happened here in a curious way is that he's lost the Ukrainian people, right? Particularly in the east, the so-called pro-Russian part of the country, they don't seem to be very happy with the situation. Initially, they seem to be more upset with the Ukrainian government, and now they appear to be more upset with the Russians. Is that what's happened?
I think that's exactly right. And that's the, in a way, that's probably the key factor, in addition to the Ukrainian army's successes. But, you know, in the final analysis, in these sorts of conflicts, the ultimate prize is the hearts and minds of the local population. And at the beginning of the conflict, back in March or April, it was arguably the case that about 30 to 40% of the eastern Ukrainian population supported Russia and wanted annexation. There were public opinion surveys to that end, which, mind you, wasn't even the majority. But nevertheless, you know, 30, 40 is significant. My guess at this point in time is that it's probably more like 3 or 4%, if that. And it's not surprising because, again, the militants have had absolutely nothing to offer to the local population other than deprivations, death, and destruction. There was a fascinating open letter written on the Ukrainian internet yesterday in Russian by a Russian-speaking Ukrainian from the city of Donetsk. And it's called An Open Letter from a Resident of Donetsk to Russia, to Russia. And he accuses Russia and the Russians of having stabbed Ukraine and Ukrainians in the back, especially people like him, who had always been pro-Russian, who had always been pro-Soviet, who had always regarded Russia and Russians as their fraternal neighbors and all that sort of stuff. And he said, after what you've done to us, what we want now is to build a 3-meter-wide wall between you and us. Stay out. And that would never have happened 4 months ago. And he says that it's not just me and my relatives. It's millions of inhabitants within this region who are now of this opinion. And I believe him. I think it's absolutely true. I mean, there's just so much evidence to suggest that the tide in terms of popular opinion has turned completely against Putin and the insurgents. And they are now, again, as I said, they're really in the position simply of being of offering absolutely nothing other than death and destruction. That's just not a winning platform. Sooner or later, the population will turn against you, and you have nothing left to do but to leave or run.
Well, if you look at the self-styled leaders of independent Ukraine or pro-Russia Ukraine, they're mostly a bunch of thugs and gangsters. And so Putin hasn't been able to field any legitimate Eastern Ukrainian political figures, apart from, you know, these thugs either on GRU's payroll or former gangsters that he's managed to put together. But what about the Russian press in that east of Ukraine? It's still strident and very much like the press in Russia is in terms of its fanning the flames of nationalism or anti-Ukrainian nationalism on the basis that the Ukrainians are a bunch of fascists. Is that still happening, and could they get away with this? If assuming that this bombing of this apartment building was done as a provocation to blame it on the Ukrainian military, will that work?
My sense is that the answer is very unlikely. It's very unlikely to work. Or, I mean, I'd even go further and say that, you know, except in the case of a few individuals who really have no access whatsoever to information, that it's just not going to work. There are still parts of that, you know, those regions in eastern Ukraine which get their information exclusively from the Russian media. But that said, there are also, I mean, people do have access to alternative sources of information. So those are beginning to get through. Ultimately, I think the question is, will people believe what they read in a news source coming from Moscow more than what they see on the ground in their own neighborhoods? And they see the commandos, the insurgents, seizing people, kidnapping them, blowing up bridges. And when they read that the Ukrainian military is engaging in these sorts of bombings, and my guess is that unless one is completely incapable of judging, you know, experience, sort of on-the-ground experience, then, you know, most people would at least have doubts and, if not indeed, actually begin to think that there's something fundamentally wrong with the propaganda. I think the experiential issue is the key here. I mean, there was a story a few days ago of a Ukrainian military unit coming into a town, again, in eastern Ukraine, and they had just liberated it from the from the terrorists, from the insurgents. And an old man came out of the cellar and said to them, "Thank God that you finally liberated us from the fascist junta in Kiev." And they said to him, "But wait a second, we are the government. We're the people who represent us." And he was shocked. But of course, in the final analysis, he came to realize that, you know, these are essentially the good guys. I mean, they're the ones who are bringing some degree of law and order back into a situation which was characterized by illegality and disorder. Well, no, my guess is, in other words, that this kind of propaganda, I mean, it works up to a point. But at some point, as I said, it begins to rub one the wrong way if it seems to contradict what one sees with one's own eyes and experiences on a daily basis.
Well, given that Putin has mastered this hybrid warfare of military action, covert operations, and disinformation, and that he is calibrating these covert attacks in a very skillful way, it would seem, because he pushes up to the limit where they won't invoke sanctions from the EU or the United States. And of course, there is a split now between the US and Germany, which is a self-inflicted wound on the European or the Western side, if you will. But there was some sense that because he and Poroshenko, the new Ukrainian leader, have a pre-existing relationship, that things might be able to be worked out. Do you see any evidence that at some point or other Putin will give up destabilizing the country and come to some modus vivendi?
If he's smart and if he has a sense of his own self-preservation, that would presumably be the conclusion he'll draw. I mean, if I'm right in suggesting that he's essentially in a dead end where the best he can possibly achieve is continued death and destruction, which really isn't a winning proposal, then the only viable alternative to that is to come up with some kind of modus vivendi. And then, you know, he could always meet with Poroshenko. They can sign a document. He can come out of it saying, we won. I always told you I would achieve victory. And it doesn't really matter what was actually done on the ground. So there's a possibility that he would do that. I mean, there may be some indications of that. And, again, it's so hard to interpret these things because in the last 4 months, what's been true of Putin is that he's been talking out of both sides of his mouth every time he talks. So it's never clear whether he's telling the truth or whether he's lying or whether he's really lying. That said, there are these overtures to the Germans, and there's this attempt ostensibly to get the OSCE and Germany somehow involved. That may simply be, and I suspect it is, really just a kind of last-ditch effort to preserve the positions of insurgents rather than a determination on the part of Putin to establish peace. That said, it is a more peaceful alternative to downing planes, sending tanks, and sowing chaos within eastern Ukraine. So it may portend some sense on his part that he's got to shift gears. There was an interesting article that just appeared, again, yesterday in the Russian press by one of the top Russian analysts saying that, and arguing something similar to what I've just said, and arguing that he expects Putin to realize very quickly that his attempt at undermining and subverting Ukraine has not worked, will not work, and that therefore this analyst believes that Putin is likely to remake himself, to reinvent himself as a peace-loving statesman who will now do everything he possibly can in order to come up with some kind of semi-legitimate resolution to the crisis that he, of course, caused himself in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, Alexander Model, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Model, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory. He's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an assessment of whether or not President Obama will be able to rein in the abusive $32 billion a year predatory for-profit college industry.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at Republic Report is For-Profit College Group APSCU has consistently harbored fraudulent schools. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thanks for having me.
And in terms of this issue of for-profit colleges and what a racket it is and how the taxpayer is being bled over $30 billion a year, and these kids that are enticed into these schools end up deeply in debt with worthless diplomas. It's sort of, we've often framed it as the worst of how Washington works, where you basically buy a bunch of politicians and you get immunity and you fist into the nation's treasury and you just make money at the expense of citizens and taxpayers and more importantly, the students. So that's a preface to a long-winded one, albeit, to the fact that at least there's been some good news lately. Finally, it looks like somebody's starting to pay attention to this problem, and one of the big for-profit operations, Corinthian, is pretty much going out of business, and now we're told that the Department of Education is going to look into the University of Phoenix and Apollo, its holding company.
That's right. Corinthian really was one of the worst schools in terms of lying to and abusing students and leaving them very deep in debt. So it's good news that the department is getting tough on a school like Corinthian. It's bad news for all the students and all the people working at Corinthian. There are some hardworking staff and instructors there who are going to face this disruption. But that is clearly not the fault of the Department of Education. It is the fault of this school. If we had strong rules in place to protect against these kinds of abuses, and if the rules were being enforced, then we wouldn't have had this abrupt collapse of Corinthian. Bad schools would gradually have to reform or go out of business. The review of Apollo, the biggest for-profit college, University of Phoenix, Apollo is the owner of, that may or may not be a big deal. It's hard to tell. They're describing it as simply a routine review. These reviews do happen from time to time. But on the other hand, we know that the department is taking a look at University of Phoenix because University of Phoenix disclosed a few months ago that the Inspector General of the Department of Education is looking at a range of University of Phoenix operations to consider whether there is improper behavior. So I do think the department is getting tougher, and it's long overdue.
But at its core, the problem seems to be that the federal government is investing over $30 billion a year into these for-profit colleges, which are able to take this taxpayer money and charge students enormous interest and give them a worthless diploma. And, you know, there may be some exceptions to it, but that is what's happened. And I'm mystified as to why, given the education crisis in this country, there hasn't been a call in Washington to invest this money in a more useful and productive way. For example, community colleges all across the country, they're all starving for funds, and they have a very, very high record of instruction and graduation. So in the category of it, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, why did we not nurture the existing community colleges that need help instead of throwing money away at these kind of people who are just parasites operating off through lobbyists to get federal money, which most of which they stuff in their pockets.
Well, you already answered the question. It's all about money. They have a lot of money, the for-profit colleges, since they're almost entirely a creature of the federal government. Most of them get almost 90% of their revenue from the federal government. The thing they've gotten really good at is not educating students. It's lobbying Congress and giving Congress campaign contributions. And they own most of the Republican Party in Congress, and they own a good chunk of the Democratic Party in Congress. And as I think I've said in your show before, members who vote with the for-profit colleges, members who otherwise vote sensibly, if you ask their staff why, it's because the biggest bundler, the biggest donor, the biggest holder of a fundraising event in their district, the biggest private equity man who summers in their state owns a for-profit college and is desperate to keep getting that money by bribing, basically, the congressman. This is corruption, plain and simple, and it continues to this day. And indeed, President Obama's signature initiative, the Gainful Employment Rule, which basically says if your students can't pay down their loans, it means your prices are too high, your quality is too low, they're not getting jobs, they're not able to pay back their loans. If that happens consistently, you will lose your federal aid, an entirely sensible proposition. That is in the process, potentially, of being gutted. We're not sure yet, and officials of the Obama administration assure me nothing's been decided, but the for-profit colleges, notwithstanding all the shame they should feel from the current exposure of their abusive students, are out there saying that they're wonderful, that they've improved, and that they don't need to be held accountable. And it is absolutely outrageous, and if they get away with it this time, then cynicism about Washington will and should continue to grow.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. Well, none other than Mitch McConnell, the minority head leader of the Senate, he was at a town hall meeting about a week ago, and he was asked by a student who's being crushed by student debt whether the government should forgive student debt. And instead, what Mitch McConnell said, what I think it would benefit from is a lot of competition. Talk about education in general. What I think it would benefit from is a lot of competition, which is one of the reasons why I'm a fan of proprietary education, which is the term for for-profit colleges, because it's providing private competition for traditional colleges and universities. And he went on to say, you know, less Yale and more for-profit schools. So do you think Mitch McConnell believes that, or...
I don't know. I saw that when they asked Mitt Romney in December of 2011, you know, what's your proposal for higher education? He said for-profit colleges are wonderful. And in fact, he singled out a school that turned out to be one of his biggest donors, and then later it turned out that his own investment company was in business with that school. So it's all, again, it's about the money. Jeb Bush spoke at the conference of the group I wrote about this week, the APSCU, APSCU. He spoke a few weeks ago at their national convention, and he said that President Obama's gainful employment rule will destroy higher education. It is a primary, a bowl to see who can compete for the money of this group. The biggest donor to Virginia Fox, who is the chair of the Higher Education Committee in the House, Representative Virginia Fox from North Carolina, is Corinthian Colleges, the school that just went down in flames as one of the worst abusers of students. The worse you are, the more money you want to spend to try to block any rule, any accountability. And Mitch McConnell knows, big donor to the Republican Party of these for-profit colleges. It is a travesty because the Republican Party is supposed to be about limited government. Here you have a program that is almost entirely dependent on federal money. And the question is, do we hold them accountable and say you only get money if you help students, or do we say we'll give you money no matter what you do to students? And he is defending the latter position, and they are paying him to do that.
So along with the payday loan companies, which are equally predatory, is this a trend now in Washington because of our corrupt money-driven politics that if you can just give politicians enough money, you can get your fist into the Treasury, and not necessarily the case of payday lenders, they don't take federal money, but they are protected by politicians. It took Holly Petraeus, the wife of General Petraeus, to force them
to, you know, they were preying on military bases, these payday lenders, and at least she's managed to get a buffer in between the payday lenders and the military bases. So, but it seems to me that the for-profit college thing is even more egregious, because it really is all about getting your fists on taxpayer money, and payoff for the taxpayer is almost zero. And the tragedy of all these aspiring kids, a lot of whom are veterans, who are trying to get an education and trying to better their lives, being conned and crippled for life for debt and end up with a worthless diploma. That just seems to be above and beyond the flagrant theft that's going on here. That's just this cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, I recently came across one story. A librarian quit at Corinthian College's Everest College in Ontario, California. She couldn't take it anymore. They had admitted a 37-year-old man who could not read. He's mentally disabled. I've watched his videos. I've talked to him on the phone. He said he wanted to be a police officer, so they admitted him to their criminal justice program. A 2-year program cost $48,000. And they, you know, tried to convince me when I confronted them with this, Corinthian, that they, with a lot of help, they could get him through the 2-year program. And I said, yeah, but is he going to be a police officer? Would you like him investigating a burglary at your home? Which resulted in the longest silence I've ever experienced talking with another person. Because, of course, he's not going to be a police officer. They don't care. They just want to deposit his financial aid checks until he drops out or graduates. And that's what's going on across the country with these schools. And then the amazing thing is that these, you know, absolutely corrupt and deceitful operations, the smiling faces who represent them in Washington are people like Trent Lott and Dick Gephardt, and the people who serve on their boards of directors, Corinthian board of directors, Mark Morial, the head of the National Urban League. They corrupt members of Congress, they buy lobbyists, and then they buy institutions. The Chronicle of Higher Education agreed to have an event on avoiding debt that was sponsored by a Career Education Corporation, one of the most predatory for-profit college companies. They certainly own the Washington Post, and even though the Washington Post is now separated from Kaplan because Jeff Bezos bought the newspaper, the Post still has their publisher is on the board of Kaplan and the same company, or the Graham Holdings company that owns Kaplan and owns a chunk of Corinthian colleges. And then they write an editorial saying, don't go forward with the gainful employment rule. So they corrupt all kinds of institutions, media, nonprofit groups that they give money to, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CRU, an organization that supposedly stands for, you know, non-corruption of Washington, continually attacks critics of for-profit colleges. We've asked them whether they're taking money from John Sperling, the head of University of Phoenix, or someone else associated with the University of Phoenix or for-profit colleges, and they won't answer. The corruption is complete because they spend in every kind of Washington institution to influence the debate. They're going to lose eventually because shame and the truth will win out here, and because we're going to, our coalition of civil rights groups and consumer groups and student groups and veterans groups are going to keep fighting until we win this fight. But it's a huge waste of our time and resources. It's an easy fix that colleges that fail students shouldn't get federal money. And yet every day I have to spend a good chunk of my time and my colleagues' time, have to spend their time fighting this ridiculous, absurd, and oppressive industry. And I, frankly, I'm tired of it, and I think your listeners should be too. And they should be demanding that President Obama issue a strong gainful employment rule, and that the federal agencies that are investigating and state attorneys general, including California's, push harder to make sure that this industry stops ripping people off. 300,000 people enroll in these schools every year, and a good chunk of them are going to have their lives and their financial futures ruined.
So this is really a very important moment, in, at least to my mind, David Halpern, for the White House on whether or not they stand up to this lobby. Because
I told them that in a meeting last week, as hard as I could.
Well, because they did fold initially, right? They tried to reform them back early in the Obama administration, did they not?
They issued a rule after a lot of proceedings in 2011 that was heavily watered down and weak. And then the department, then the for-profit college industry via its trade organization, APSCU, hired Gibson Dunn, one of the biggest law firms in the country, the one that represented George Bush and Bush v. Gore, and they went to court and got the rule struck down as because they didn't explain adequately one of the three prongs of it. So the department has to rerun the entire procedure. Now they have a slightly tougher rule, but it could get watered down again because the rule hasn't been finalized. And they've already admitted, the Trade Association, a document that I obtained, that they're going to go to court and get it, try to strike it down no matter what it says.
But it seems to me what's at stake here is really, this is a sort of metaphor for where we stand as a nation in terms of our politics. If the President of the United States, who looks as though he wants to do the right thing here, because it's just immoral to have federal money go essentially be stolen like this in plain sight and have these rackets protected by lobbyists. If he really wants to do the right thing and can't do the right thing for reasons are not entirely clear to me,
yeah.
Then what does it say? I mean, so walk me through that. Is that if he can't do the right thing, why?
Well, the president has made clear in his remarks, both scripted and off the cuff, that he absolutely understands what the scam is here. When he spoke at Binghamton, New York, he answered a question last year, made clear he gets it. So the question is, why wouldn't he issue a rule tough enough to match that rhetoric? And the answer seems to be this. They know there's a solid block of Republicans and Democrats who are bought by this industry that actually can prevail on a vote in the House. In the Senate, it's harder because most of the Democrats, led by Tom Harkin, Dick Durbin, Elizabeth Warren, are tough on this issue, and it's going to be harder. But there is a risk that Congress could take action to overturn a tough gainful employment rule. And that's what they're worried about. And I think they're worried that some people could say, well, this is like Obamacare, another federal overreach in the private sector. Of course, this isn't a private sector program. It's a welfare program paid for by the government. We have every right to demand accountability. But they have some fear. I think that there are some members of Congress who say that they're advocates for students who call the president and say, look, I'm with you on this issue of cracking down, but you don't want to embarrass yourself. So the rule should only go so far, and it should be heavily grounded in studies, outside studies, or you know, other ways to try to convince them to water it down. Those members, in fact, for whatever reason, are doing the bidding of for-profit colleges because of their connections to those people. And what should happen is the president was elected to make a difference, and one of the things he promised was reduce the role of money in politics. He's also promised to help our students, to help make college education affordable and useful. He will break those promises if he listens to these lobbyists. He's got nothing to lose by issuing a tough rule, nothing at all. He's been reelected. If the rule gets overturned, which I don't think it will, he can veto the provision overturning it. He ought to stand up and be tough about this, because in the end, there are more voters and more, you know, reporters and more concerned citizens who are going to say he did the right thing. The only people on the other side on this issue are people being paid or people being fooled. And this is as clear-cut an issue as anyone I've ever worked on. And lobbyists who work for this industry have taken me aside, people I know, and admitted to me their shame and their awareness that they're on the wrong side of this issue, because they absolutely are.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at Republic Report is For-Profit College Group APSCU Has Consistently Harbored Fraudulent Schools. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side to sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.